Hello, my name is Holly Lewis.
I'm Lawson Keeney.
And I am Jean Lewis.
And welcome to The Long Watch, the internet's premier pro John Lithgow podcast, where we stick to the list for better or worse. This week we are in much different territory. I don't know how else to say it. Piranha 3D. Horror comedy, aquatic in nature, as indicated by the fish. But first, we're going to talk about what we've seen within the week. We saw two films in the cinema together.
We did indeed.
We had a bit of a night of it.
Yes. The first of them is Evil Dead Rise. It's a supernatural horror film directed by Lee Cronin. And it's about this woman named Beth, played by Lily Sullivan. She goes to visit her sister Ellie, played by Alyssa Sutherland, and her children in the apartment building they live in. But then there's an earthquake, and the parking lot sort of splits open at the bottom of the building and reveals a buried bank vault in which the kids find an old book, the Book of the Dead, and one of the kids reads it, which basically unleashes all of the deadites, the evil dead demons. They possess Ellie and cut off all of the exits to the floor that they're on, and so Beth has got to protect her nieces and nephew and find some way out of there. So why don't you guys say what you thought of it, and then I'll get into my thing. Why don't you start us off, John?
Yep, I loved this. This is exactly what I wanted from the movie. It's nasty. It's gritty. It has humor. It's trying to speak about how family can hurt us more than anyone else. And the Deadites have a lot of fun with that. Their petty evil just really works in this case because they get people to say just the most awful things, the most nasty manipulations, and that's fantastic. The effects in here are really great. The practical effects, I mean, the blood, the mucus, the damage done to people is incredible. And I love the character relationships here. Ellie and her children have such a close-knit, they're just such a close-knit group. And you can tell how much they love each other. And then that gets ripped away. And Beth is such an interesting character as well, because she's the cool aunt who sort of comes into town and sort of is the fun, exciting one, while Ellie has to, you know, be the mom. And that's such a great idea for an Evil Dead film. It leads me to believe that they'll be doing more stuff like this in the future, because this one has been critically very well received in terms of being an Evil Dead film. And I just love the idea of them being like, oh, Evil Dead in a skyrise worked. Oh, maybe Evil Dead in an old museum, or Evil Dead in the 1800s in the Old West, or the Evil Dead in the Vatican, or stuff like that. There's so many ideas, and this is proof positive that it doesn't have to be in a cabin in the woods. It doesn't have to be with Ash Williams to be an excellent Evil Dead movie. I think I liked this more than Fede Alvarez's Evil Dead, but that original Evil Dead 2 has such a space in my heart. Even Army of Darkness just appeals to me as a fan of these kinds of things. But I really loved Evil Dead Rise. The intro sequence is just pure Evil Dead.
Yeah, so I had a fantastic time with this. I have a lot of love for the Evil Dead franchise, even though some of those earlier ones are, frankly, not the best. But I just love the concept. These Deadites, these demons, they aren't looking for anything big or grand. They just want to hurt you. And all of that's embodied in Alyssa Sutherland's performance as Ellie, the mother who gets possessed by the Deadite. She's incredible. She's fantastic. And basically everybody in this movie is really, really good at what they're trying to do. Especially the people who end up as Deadites. I love the practical effects here. The gore is honestly second to none. Which is something you'll hear again later. And I just think that they nailed the tone. The earlier Evil Dead movies are a little too goofy for me on a rewatch. And Fede Alvarez is unrelenting in his version of the Evil Dead. This kind of mixes the two. We're not getting, like, dancing stop motion skeletons like in Evil Dead 2. So it is a little more like Freddy Alvarez's Evil Dead, and it has less blood than the Evil Dead remake, which really doesn't tell you anything else other than that this is not that version of Evil Dead, because no other movie has more blood than that. Cast is strong, the themes are strong. I just had a great time with this. I love the location, too. I would love to see an Evil Dead on, like, a cruise liner.
Or a plane.
You know,
in-flight
Evil
plane.
Dead Air.
Evil Dead on the International Space Station.
Evil Dead on
It's Evil Dead on a plane. You call it, instead of Evil Dead Rise, Evil Dead Fall.
That would work.
Evil Dead on Air Force One. that would be nuts. But no, this had charm, it was funny, it was tragic, and everyone nailed it. And just the color palette is brilliant too, and it's kind of everything I wanted it to be, ultimately.
I thought this movie was very, very entertaining. It's gory, it's intense, it is much more in the mode of the 2013 remake than any of the original movies, which is the way I prefer this franchise. Frankly, I have spoken before about how I run out of patience with Sam Raimi's more slapstick tendencies pretty quickly.
But this one does have more pep.
Yes, yes. It does have a lot more sort of... it's not quite the grind that the 2013 one is, and I say that the 2013 one is still my favorite in the franchise, but that's a movie that is like just...
It's unrelenting.
It's rubbing your face in the dismay of it all the way through, and this has a little more, like you say, pep.
I mean, they do the eye spot from this second movie.
Which was my least favorite part of this movie. It sets up a likable cast, I think, with very good performances. I will agree with you that Sutherland is just extraordinary, and they make such good use of her. They build a lot of really creepy imagery and set pieces around her, and she pulls them off so fantastically. But you've also got strong cast aside from her. Sullivan as Beth is very, very strong, and I really thought that the performer of the older daughter, Gabrielle Eccles, was... quite a strong performer as well. I thought I had seen her in something before, but no, she's...
Same!
She's fairly new on the scene. She hasn't done anything really other than...
Yeah.
She was in Reminiscence.
I thought the same thing. Yeah. I was like, I definitely seen her before, but
well,
no.
She had like a kind of a Joey King energy or something like that.
A little bit,
which I think was maybe what was tripping me up. But once the movie gets going, it's just absolutely relentless and it doesn't slow down. It has some extremely cringe-inducing violence. It earns its R rating in Australia. You have to work to get an R rating, and this one works. There's a sequence with like a cheese grater, which elicited a visceral reaction from me in the cinema. Perhaps fittingly, I believe I sounded like a chainsaw. I was like, no, 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 no.
People like us, we don't like little holes.
It's
okay. That sounded way more dirty than you probably intended it to.
Like,
but
it's like
it's a textural thing. It's like
tryptophobia or something like that.
I don't have a problem with that. I got the more of this, like the idea of
you can
the
picture it.
The grater on flesh
you can picture it. It's like
I will say I don't think it makes enough use of the Skyrise setting. The high-rise setting, I think they could do more. It tends to just remain in the apartment. There are other people on the floor that the deadites are on, but it doesn't engage with them as much as I wish it would. It really does use it as aesthetic more than as a plot device. It strips away a lot of the potential narrative threads of that being in an apartment building could create, and instead focuses on another. We're trapped inside this apartment instead of a cabin, and a lot of the same things are happening. I think they could have done something, and maybe I'm asking for something that the budget couldn't give them. Like if they had actually gone out on like a fire escape or something, or if they tried to like go down an elevator shaft or into a stairwell or who knows. But I feel like there was a way to use the verticality a lot more than they did. I do think it goes on a little too long. I think if you lost maybe 10 minutes there, I think it would sing just a little bit more, but I will agree with you that the effects are really extraordinary. And I gotta say, I've said a lot of things, and I will continue to say a lot of things about the reign of Papa Zaslav at Warner Brothers Discovery, but the best decision he has made is pivoting back to cinema away from streaming releases, because this is a movie that was made for distribution on HBO Max. It was its intended release, and after Zaslav took over, he was one of the first to realize, hey, this streaming thing doesn't make nearly as much money as putting movies in cinemas and then releasing them on streaming. And so
And he's all about that
he's all
cash.
about that cold hard cash. But
I
this
mean,
was
look
one
at
of
the
the.
things he's been saying about the writer's strike, how people will, oh, they'll come back to their jobs because they love it.
But this was one of the first movies that he sort of pivoted back to a theatrical release, and it's paid off, because this movie has done really well. It cost $15 to $19 million, and it's made 93.7 million worldwide, which is a really, really good result, I
That's a
think.
pretty phenomenal
And
return.
I believe is yeah, it's very much it's closing in on being the highest grossing in the franchise. Another week or two, and it probably will be.
Utterly
But
deserved.
yeah. Anyways, we also went and directly following Evil Dead Rise saw a very different movie, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. It's a superhero movie directed by James Gunn. It's based on the Marvel comics, and I'm not going to go too deep into the plot because I think that the trailer did a very good job of obscuring it. I don't think that they necessarily want you to know too much about where the plot is. Suffice to say that the Guardians go on a journey that sheds light on the backstory of Rocket, played by Bradley Cooper, and his creation at the hands of this Dr. Moreau-esque villain called the High Evolutionary, who's played by Chukwudi Ugwuji. So why don't you guys say what you thought of it? Why don't you start us off, Sean?
I really enjoyed the tone of this. It is much more solemn and much more somber than the past Guardians movies, but it still has some moments of really great comedy. And you're seeing the best performances in the franchise out of these members of the cast in terms of them playing their characters. Karen Gillan is excellent as Nebula in this, and it really does show how much she's grown as a character. Rocket, for almost the first time in the entire MCU, is a character that I really understand now. They do a lot of good stuff here about his backstory and about why he really is the way he is in terms of his attitude, and he really is the main focus of the film. You also get there's a lot in this film that is about looking under the surface and seeing people for who they really are, which comes to the character of the High Evolutionary, played brilliantly by Chukwudi Ugwuji, who doesn't really have anything inside. He is a cold, mean, evil person. He experiments on animals. He blows up worlds without even a second thought. He doesn't really have a higher purpose. He doesn't really have a higher meaning. He thinks that it is his purpose, that it is his right to be a god. And unlike Thanos, actually kind of acts like one, bizarrely. And he is such an entertaining villain because he is not sympathetic in the slightest, which some other MCU villains have been. And Chris Pratt, I think he really nails this performance here. He is playing a very sad version of Star-Lord, Peter Quill, and it works here. He's able to really dig deep into a place where he hasn't been able to really go in any other roles other than Star-Lord, which is really interesting. And I would like to see more of that kind of performance from him when he isn't just sort of, as Harley would say, mugging for the camera.
No,
But yeah.
it's the two modes, goofball and mopey.
Yeah, but he does an excellent job here. John Murphy also does a really good job at creating the score for this. It's not really like Tyler Bates' score. It is more ephemeral, it's more serious.
It's more considered.
Its tone is very interesting, but when the Guardians theme comes in, and it is Tyler Bates' Guardians theme, it is there to punctuate moments where things are really working for the Guardians. Because for the vast majority of the film, things aren't going well for them, and that's so interesting. But yeah, I loved the effects here, the focus on Rocket, and the focus on sadness. It allows the movie to have a lot of pathos and really come out the other end feeling like the culmination of the stories of these characters.
For me, this is my favorite Guardians movie, pretty easily, and it might be James Gunn's best, because he melds the tone perfectly here. Because obviously he still has a lot of humor in his script, but is merged with a really sincere story about, moving on in a lot of ways and trying to figure out what your place in the world is or in the galaxy is, when you are trying to get away from your own past, not running from, but finally confronting and getting over it. Chuck Rudy Iwuji is phenomenal as the High Evolutionary. I would disagree about the cold comment. He's not. He's an incredibly passionate individual, but what he's passionate about is creating the perfect organism. And whenever he has one of his creations have an element of themselves more perfect, than is already existing within him, he kind of loses his mind. And that's really fun to see. I really look forward to more of Iwuji's career, because he's phenomenal. But this movie does really focus on Rocket. A lot of the other Guardians get pushed to the side a bit for this, and I think that is a really good thing. Because we actually understand where Rocket's coming from. We even get flashbacks to, and these are seen in the trailers to Rocket when he's really young and just sort of created. And Sean Gunn is playing young Rocket, and he's phenomenal as well, because some of that work as young Rocket is just some heartbreaking shit, if I'm gonna be completely honest. The movie also looks very good. I've always respected Gunn's clarity and his pace. Like, the dude knows when to cut a scene, end a scene, and make it work. If this is the energy he's bringing into the DCU, we're in for some really good stuff. Because he's finally found it. He's finally found exactly where the tone lands. You know what I mean? It just works. Will Poulter as Adam Warlock is a hilarious thing to me, because a lot of Adam Warlock fans online are getting real pissy about how he's used here. And it's like, gang, come on. Gunn teased Adam Warlock at the end of Guardians 2 before Infinity War and Endgame. And those are important stories in the comics for Warlock. So he's kind of got nothing to do in the broader sense of things. So it's really just Gunn fulfilling the promise of Adam Warlock rather than adapting him straight. And Will Poulter is where some of the funniest moments in the film are from. Because he's kind of this himbo character.
Yeah.
And that's great.
It's great to see the evolution of Gunn as a filmmaker and storyteller. Lawson?
I thought that this was a very worthy farewell for what has been one of the most consistently high quality sub-series in the MCU. It's really about the team. It's about their relationships with each other, the characters, their development. It's full of heart and emotion. It's kind of an extended therapy session for the whole group. Gunn has always been the best writer in the MCU at having actual conflicts between his characters that are born out of personality friction, and not just what's going on in the narrative. Like, you have arguments and disagreements just that are born out of how these people relate to each other. And that's some of the strongest stuff. It's what makes them real. It's what gives it such emotional impact. I do agree that it's not as funny as the two previous films. It still is funny, don't get me wrong, but it's more emotional instead. And it does hit home. I think it ties off all of the character arcs very nicely. Quite honestly, I like that not all of them are neat, not all of them are just, the perfect happy ending, but they all feel right. They all feel cathartic and like a proper ending. I do think it can sometimes go a tad too far in its earnestness. There are a lot of flashbacks involving Rocket that I think in particular step over this boundary, where he's hanging out with a couple of other genetically engineered animals, and there's one scene in particular where they're sort of like discussing what the sky might look like, and then they give each other names, basically. They will give themselves names. And it's done in such a sort of Sesame Street kind of tone and way. And I'm just spending the whole thing waiting for a punchline because it just is so treacly sweet and sort of these high-pitched animal voices. And that punchline never came. It's just this weird acid trip of a scene that I just think is miscalculated. And there are a few little examples like that.
I disagree. That one, that scene really worked for me.
All right, we'll have to agree to disagree then. But I also felt, as much as I enjoyed Adam and Will Poulter, I thought he was entirely unnecessary.
Oh
Oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
You could
He's
cut.
like no question at
completely
all.
pointless.
This is a 2.5 hour movie. It doesn't need to be. We can cut Adam. The only reason he's there is because, frankly, they needed to kind of clean up the tease that they had left at the end of two, when I imagine Gunn didn't know whether they were going to need Adam's services or not in the Infinity War stuff. Gamora also feels a little forced in. Again, this is something that they need to clean up. It's part of the emotional catharsis of the series that Gamora's arc be resolved and her relationship with Quill be resolved. But the way that they facilitate her coming back into contact with the group, it doesn't feel the most natural, doesn't feel the most earned. But what are you going to do? Has great performances though. I think Pratt is surprisingly good. He is the best he's been in the whole series. He has some really strong moments, not just comedically, but like proper dramatic acting as well. I back both of you guys. This guy, Chuck Wooty-Awoogie, is absolutely magnificent. He is a phenomenal villain, a really great performance. I looked him up afterwards. He's been in Peacemaker, which is obviously where James Gunn knows him from, but he's mostly seems to be a British stage actor. He's done a lot of stage work.
You could
So,
feel the stage on him. It's like when you see him act, you can smell the theatrical haze. Like, he just has a presence.
there's so much Shakespeare in this performance.
So I will be very, very interested to see if he gets more sort of big movie parts now. I think that he could carve out a really fantastic career in the theatrical space. There's a top tier use of music, licensed music and songs, like there always is. I think that the final song that they choose is kind of perfect. And it's so sort of unlike the other songs that have been used in the series up until that point, and that's what makes it work.
I do love the song they choose right at the beginning. I'm not going to say what it is, but it's a good pick.
There's also a very strong original score by John Murphy. I thought it was a really, really enjoyable movie, one of the stronger ones that the MCU has put out recently. And I'm generally a fan of what the MCU has been doing recently, but I think this is probably the strongest since Doctor Strange.
Yeah, that's probably. I would agree. Where would you rank this one on the Guardians movies?
Oh, that's tough because I've got so much history with the other two. It's sort of growing in my estimation the more time I have to think about it and the more time I have to sit with it as an ending for a lot of these characters. I mean, not all of them. They've already said that Chris Pratt's already said and that Star-Lord's going to be back, but it's very clearly the conclusion of this iteration of the Guardians of the Galaxy at any rate. But I don't know where I'd rank it. I think, I don't know, maybe second. I'm just not sure which one of the other two would be below it. I'd have to really give it a think. Maybe watch them all in sequence. But I enjoyed it a lot. You guys have been asking me a lot why I chose Piranha 3D this week, and the reason is basically the other options. They're not bad movies, but they're also not movies we get a lot of discussion about. I am going to talk about one at the end that I'm sure you'll be like, oh, why didn't we do this one? But I didn't watch it before last week's episode. I sort of slotted it in here to make next week's what we've been watching a little less heavy. So I didn't know basically to select it. First up here is Dorian Gray. It is a gothic drama directed by Oliver Parker. It's based on the Oscar Wilde novel The Picture of Dorian Gray. It's set in the 1890s, and it follows a young British aristocrat named Dorian Gray, played by Ben Barnes. He returns to London after his father dies to collect his inheritance, his estate, and there he falls under the mentorship of the cynical libertine Henry Wotton, played by Colin Firth. And the sort of the hedonism of Wotton sort of pushes Gray further and further, and at the same time he's getting his portrait painted by an artist named Basil Hallward, played by Ben Chaplin. And he soon discovers that his indulgences affect the painting. So whatever would happen to his body, age, disease, instead infects the painting and leaves him looking exactly as he always did. And as his soul corrodes, the painting does also, and he keeps it locked away so no one knows his secret. This version is sort of Oscar Wilde meets Hellraiser. It really does reveal how vital and urgent this story can still be, and how there is a lot of ways that this book could benefit from a modern interpretation with the kind of relaxation of moral standards when it comes to art that we now have. I mean, the big famous version of this story was done in film in the 40s when the Hays Code was still in. But they're able to push it in this movie in a way that they obviously weren't in the 40s. I think, though, it's still too bland. It's kind of R-rated masterpiece theatre. It needs to be a bit more. It needs to be wilder. It needs basically more Hellraiser. It does engage with some of the queer subtext in the book. Obviously, Oscar Wilde is one of the most famous gay men in all of human history. He was tried for his gayness because homosexuality was still a sin, was still considered a sin, and still outlawed
A crime, yeah.
under British law, and would be for quite a long time. But basically, it's very difficult to read a lot of Wilde's repertoire and not see how he's talking about a lot of that stuff through his work. And certainly when I read the book a few years ago, that was something that was very much present.
Well, that draws a pretty big line to Clive Barker. Considering he is a gay man and has involved that in a lot of his stories, obviously able to make it more explicit.
The movie does make some smart adaptational choices. There is a time jump in the book, but it's only 18 years. Here it's 25 years thereabouts. And unlike Wilde, who was writing this book in the 1890s, these filmmakers knew exactly what the world would look like 25 years from the time that the character starts. So they're actually able to do some really interesting things with, like, no, when the story picks up after that time jump, it's World War One, and there are cars now, and like you see the development of the world in a way that the book just couldn't, because Oscar Wilde had no way of knowing that this is where the world was going. And they tie that through into the sort of like the lack of aging, the sort of eternal presence of Dorian Gray in a really interesting way. Barnes is okay as the lead character, but Firth just steals the show as his sort of seducer into immorality, this guy Henry Wotton. He's a lot of fun. They make this third act change that is conceptually a good idea, but they don't execute it well enough. They don't justify it. They don't explore the idea enough to really earn it. I think that the handling of the portrait is mostly effective, though. There are some very sort of creepy, grisly developments on the painting, the more that his behavior gets less and less restrained. But they do these sort of like terrible, very ill-judged effects where like the painting will suddenly go, "Wah!" And it's sort of clearly, or it seems to me, clearly done a decision they made in post. So it's simply a warping of the flat surface using a computer, and it just
feels
looks
like a
terrible.
studio thing,
Yeah.
like to keep the suits a little more on the edge of their seat.
But you can really see watching this movie how in the hands of a filmmaker with a more specific point of view, and frankly, more free rein to get a little bit wilder,
Yeah.
an update could be really effective for this story. I next saw Centurion. It is a historical action thriller directed by Neil Marshall. It's set in the early 2nd century, and it imagines the fate of the legendary Roman Lost Legion. The Lost Legion were this, legion of thousands of Roman soldiers who just up and vanished, and history has no record of what happened to them. But this movie imagines a devastating ambush by tribesmen called the Picts, and a small group of survivors led by Quintus Dius, played by Michael Fassbender, try to get home from behind enemy lines after everyone else is wiped out. This is solid, it's capable, but it's not very memorable. The legend of the Lost Legion is a very good jumping-off point. I think it's a pretty ordinary explanation for what happened to them, but it does lead to some decent sort of chase stuff. This is a chase movie. I kind of wonder, given Neil Marshall's credentials with Dog Soldiers and The Descent and Doomsday, whether coming up with a more supernatural explanation for the Legion's disappearance would have been more interesting and more in his wheelhouse. But that wouldn't have allowed them to go with the most interesting element that this movie has, which is sort of an undercurrent of Iraq and Afghanistan and even Vietnam in terms of its connection to modern day war and political imperialism, basically. That there is very much a correlation drawn between Rome as this sort of incredibly powerful, sprawling imperial force and America and its misadventures in various theaters of war like Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, in which they were technologically superior, but faced with an enemy that had real guerrilla tactics and were fighting on their own home turf. And through that sort of lens, it explores some of those ideas of imperialism and it interrogates those ideas. I mean, it's not about America, that's there in the reading. But it is very much also about Rome and about, Rome's insistence on dominating other cultures and absorbing them into the whole of the Roman Empire. And even though the heroes or the protagonists are Roman, Marshall does a good job of exploring how the Roman Empire was not a good thing for a lot of the cultures that it took over, and that the behavior of a lot of the soldiers towards the locals in those areas was horrific. It does a pretty good job of illustrating the horrors of war and sort of like the weird,
It's Empire.
the bloodthirstiness of that era. It's at its best with that stuff, but it doesn't end up doing enough with it. That's all the most interesting stuff, but it's Marshall doesn't seem to come up with an idea of how to tie it into the main thrust of the plot. It does have an excellent scale, though, given it was made on only a $12 million budget. He's out there shooting in, European forests and things and mountains. Really a pretty extraordinary look to it. Design with all of the outfits and things. He gets a lot of bang for his buck. The locations are just gorgeous, and he's managed to get a lot of extras on site, like these scenes of the Romans, marching the whole legion before they're wiped out. That's a lot of people on screen. And the action's very visceral. A lot of chopped arms and beheaded heads and blood squirting everywhere. And it's quite, it's all practical. Like it's very much in camera sort of thing. So just as a filmmaking exercise, it's quite a strong showing. But you have a cast of people too who have become a lot more recognizable in the interim. Obviously, we have Fassbender, but also Dominic West, Liam Cunningham, David Morrissey, and Riz Ahmed are also in the film.
Hey.
So you get a lot of good supporting performances from recognizable faces. Lastly, this week, the movie that I didn't watch in the same week as all of the others, and I hadn't watched before I did the recorded
Are
the
you gonna make
episode
me
last time.
are you gonna make me pissed at you?
Maybe it's Tomorrow When the War Began.
Eh.
It's a young adult.
For a moment, I thought you were going to say Social Network. Then no. I would have slammed my headphones down and walked away.
No, I actually haven't watched The Social Network yet. I was going to last night, but I was overtaken by events. It's a young adult thriller, Tomorrow When the War Began Is, not Social Network, directed by Stuart Beatty, and it's based on the book of the same name by John Marsden. It's set in country Australia when a group of teenagers go camping in the woods for the weekend, and when they come back, they find that the country has been invaded in their absence, and they start a guerrilla campaign and attempt to avoid lawsuits from the producers of Red Dawn.
That is an interesting element of... the story around Tomorrow the War Began.
Oh, it's so Red Dawn. It's Red Dawn from beginning to end. It's our Red Dawn. It's like you can't get around it. There's no like I know that, you know, people have tried to lodge defenses against it, but just it's so completely. Having seen both Red Dawns, the original and the remake, there's no getting around it. It's a simple structure, but it works like a charm. The early goings are the best. There's a lot of tension and intrigue as they're sort of trying to figure out what's happened. There's like a real, real tenseness to them finding
like
planes flying overhead.
Yeah.
They come home, everything's deserted. One of them, their dog is shot dead in the front lawn and the whole place is deserted. Like, there's some really tense stuff. And
it's almost post-apocalyptic.
In some ways, yeah, it's got that kind of tone to it. Like, all of the rules of society are gone, and now it's all about survival.
Yeah, because all of these kids, they go camping in a place called Hell, and then when they come back, they really enter it.
We read the book for high school.
Yeah, so did I. But it's a really remote area, so they're really in the bush with no cell phone reception. So they have no idea what's going on. But what makes this really interesting, what makes it kind of work the most, is that it's very concentrated on the immediate. There's no big picture. You don't really get an impression of what's going on anywhere other than what these teenagers are experiencing. They never even identify who the invader is.
To the point where they have the invaders speak in several different languages.
Yes, yes. It's just amalgamation of them, I think. Yeah. But obviously, in the books, Marsden never says who the invaders are, and he never gives a detailed description of them either.
It's like it's like in Top Gun Maverick, who the enemy fighter pilots are from. It's like, we can't say anybody.
In the movie, obviously, they had to make a call, and they ended up casting Asian actors as the invading soldiers, which makes logical sense given the location of Australia in the world.
It makes the nearest
powers with the ability to launch a ground invasion of this country are Asian countries.
Yeah, and it gives the impression of North Korea.
This is the thing. Apparently, it's something that Marsden wrote like a sequel trilogy later on, and this movie kind of parrots it. There is the suggestion that it is a coalition of multiple smaller countries who are no longer able to survive without Australia's resources and basically have invaded to take over the country.
So it's not one specific
country or ethnic group.
It is a
coalition. I think that they say that it's a group of Asian countries, smaller Asian countries in the Asian Pacific, but I think that's actually a mistake that Marsden made in his books. I think in his rush to not identify or not blame a specific country, he's actually kind of made it sort of a homogenous Asian force.
Yeah.
Which is
well, that's the danger of being specific.
Yeah, it was a better call in the original seven books to just not describe them. But anyways, it kind of ties into some things that wasn't especially current in the discourse when he started writing the books, but became very current after they were published, is this sort of the way that immigration got weaponized as a political thing in this country, the way that people started using terms like invasion to describe asylum seekers and refugees and all of our horrific policies before them. Because of our cultural experience since these books came out, we attach a really unfortunate connotation to some of these things that were not intended in the original text. And so Marsden and the The people who have tried to adapt Tomorrow When the War Began have sort of been trying to outrun that ever since, and I don't think they do a really great job of it because for reasons I've already discussed, but it's not really a part of the story itself. It's just something that's probably just worth acknowledging, given all of the stuff going on in Australian culture around it. But the movie has a really decent scale and scope. There are a lot of swooping landscape shots. There are big pyrotechnic effects. It's Australian cinema trying to do something that we so rarely try, which is to be big and ambitious and to really make a blockbuster. And what it revealed was that we don't have the population to support that on our own. If we spend that much money, we need it to take off internationally, like Mad Max did, for example. And this movie did not take off internationally. And so, even though it clearly had eyes for a franchise to adapt the rest of the series, the book, and so the movie ends on a big cliffhanger with no resolution. We never got that resolution. You'll have to read the books, and I intend to. I want to go back and read the whole thing with an adult's eyes. I think I read the first two books when I was in high school and then just sort of dropped off, but I would be interested in seeing it. I do think that the cast is hit or miss, though. Caitlin Stacey is the lead, and she's very good. Obviously, Susan's stepdaughter from Neighbours, she learned from the best. But she definitely, I mean, she has gone on to have a number of fairly high-profile roles in American TV especially, but she was also in Smile, the horror movie last year. She, of the cast here, is definitely the highest profile. But you've got some other people like Lincoln Lewis and Rachel Heard Wood, who was Alan Rickman's daughter in Perfume. But has not really done much since this movie. There's a lot of ADR though, and I kind of it, like very obvious ADR, and I was kind of wondering watching it whether it was something to do with the environment that they were shooting outdoors a lot of the time. But it seems to focus on some actors more than others, and it made me wonder if they were so sort of trying to foolproof it for an international release that they were tamping down accents in post. I don't know. It would be interesting to see whatever the raw footage was to try and compare that. But in
That
the end,
can be shooting out in the bush, especially in a location that looks as hell does, is pretty tough.
Well, it just seems to focus on specific actors so much, whereas people like Caitlin Stacey barely get it at all.
That is odd.
But yeah, it would be interesting to find that out, because obviously, infamously, Mad Max did the same thing when they released it first off in America. All you could get in America was a dubbed version with American voice actors over
It's
everyone
so
else.
bad.
It's
It's so
terrible.
bad.
But I don't understand it personally. I don't think the Australian accent is that difficult to understand. But then again, I've got this
We're
theory,
not
right?
Welsh.
I've got well, I don't have a hard time understanding most accents, but I've got this theory that Americans have a harder time understanding international accents than a lot of other countries do because Americans are sort of insulated through pop culture. There's so much pop culture is American, is Hollywood, is American accents. They don't listen to other accents as much as most other countries do. Like we grew up watching a lot of American TV, watching a lot of British TV because the BBC sends a lot of stuff to the ABC and stuff like that. I wonder whether we just have more practice at understanding people who don't sound like us.
No, I do think you have a really good point there. It'd be interesting to look into that in like a sociological study kind of way.
I do think that the script and the dialogue of this movie can be pretty rough, though, sometimes. Again, it's not like we aren't Britain. We don't have the film industry. We don't have the population to support the film industry. We're under a 30 million person population. And once you get rid of the people doing all the other jobs, the doctors, the police people, the teachers, the firefighters, the plumbers, the builders, the accountants, the politicians, it leaves very, very little percentage to maintain a functioning film industry. And that's why so many of our films tend to be so small. But we just don't have a lot of practice at this, and I think you can kind of see that in some places here. But I found it really compelling still. I really enjoyed it. It's available for streaming on Stan in Australia if anyone's interested. But that's me done for the week. What about you guys? What have you been watching?
So this week is Zombie Week. It is, of course, the most recent themed.
Look, I know that you're not a monarchist, but just because you watched the coronation last night doesn't make it Zombie Week.
There were very, very... Okay. There were shambling old people who might smell like death. It counts. But the first... I'm just going to go first, but the movies were in a different order.
No, I'll go first.
Okay, sure.
So we have watched the granddaddy of the zombie idea. The one that made it pounce into Hollywood and really started the idea. Night of the Living Dead.
Have you guys seen this before?
Yeah.
It would have been a while ago.
Yeah.
This is directed by George Romero. Many years ago, in a quiet Pennsylvanian countryside, the dead began to walk the earth. Fueled with an insatiable hunger for human flesh, the ghouls inadvertently bring together six strangers whose inability to unite ultimately leads to their tragic downfall. This is the big, big, big zombie movie. This is the one that made it really branch over to pop culture. It invented whole cloth, a bunch of ideas about zombies that it sort of took vaguely from Haitian folklore. The eating of human flesh, the destruction of the brain, the slight fear of fire, the horde aspect, and it does a really good job at all of that stuff. This goes in directions that you wouldn't expect from a movie from 1968, and really has an interesting opinion about people in crisis. The way that people fall together and break apart, almost like crashing waves. It's very interesting in terms of that. Our main focus here is Dwayne Jones as Ben. He has taken shelter in this house and is trying to keep the place safe. And that brings him into conflict with the other people seeking shelter. Judith O'Dea as Barbara, Carl Hardman as Harry Cooper, and Marilyn Eastman as Helen Cooper. This is iconic. This is... Yes, I'll let Harley say his piece.
Okay. So, like John indicated... and took a while to say, this is the progenitor of the zombie idea in pop culture. You do not have everything else without this.
I'm sorry, can I just... I can't stop by without acknowledging the expert sass of that. Like Jean indicated, but took a while to say.
I have my moments. But no, this is the beginning of the entire idea of the zombie as pop culture icon. And this movie is a bit slow. I will say that. It spends a vast majority of its runtime just having the cast boarding up windows. And the zombies are kind of interesting here. There are a lot of elements present that don't appear in later versions of the idea. The idea that they don't like light. And so they smash out the headlights of the car that's outside and still running. It's the idea that they can sort of the rudimentary use of tools.
Yeah.
And there's no strategy involved. It's rather basic, but there's a sort of base pack cunning.
Well, that's sort of something
involved.
A lot of people sort of forget about Romero's interpretation is that in pretty much all of his movies, he includes the suggestion that there is, like, the echo of the person that was, that they still remember a lot of things, and that they are able to, as you said, Harley, do things like use tools, and obviously he will explore that idea more and more as his six Living Dead movies go on. But it's sort of that whole idea of just brains is actually...
It's reductive.
The sort of the generic blend of what Romero did, taken and filtered down over so many knockoffs.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's...
But there's actually a lot more going on with the zombies here.
They're not necessarily zombies. They are the living dead.
Yes,
this is kind of a side tangent. It's probably worth establishing that what we sort of know as the zombies, the brains thing, that actually comes from Return of the Living Dead, which...
Yeah.
was sort of a kind of spin-off of the Romero Living Dead series. It was sort of because of all of the weird stuff going on with copyright with the Romero Living Dead series, it was sort of basically who had the rights to make sequels, and basically the deal that was struck with between Romero and one of his collaborators on the first movie was that Romero could do the Of the Dead stuff and that this guy could go on and do Return of the Living Dead and the Living Dead things. And they basically became two separate and distinct series. But a
Yeah,
lot of
absolutely.
that sort of slightly goofier, slightly more sort of like pulpy, less intellectual stuff that that basically dominates how we view zombies in a lot of ways, that stuff comes from Return of the Living Dead, which is a great
Yeah.
movie, but not nearly
Oh,
as
wow.
high-minded as what Romero's doing.
No, and one of the really interesting elements here is, as John said, the idea that in a crisis people fall apart. Sometimes people find strength and find purpose in a calamity, and others just seek to protect their own. And that's a very interesting dynamic here. I just think the movie takes a glacially long time to get to that.
Yeah.
And that is what is perhaps the major failing here. Most of the movie is incredible, don't get me wrong. When it pops off, it pops off. But it takes so long to get there. We watched it twice. The first time we tried to watch it, I fell asleep. And that's pretty rare. I've only done that a few times when watching a movie. Dune is one of them, but that was for a completely different reason.
That's because that was the Denis Villeneuve movie.
he makes me sleepy. But no, I also found the ending incredibly striking. I've always found the ending incredibly striking because it's just so brutal. It's just so effective. Our kind of lead character here, sort of our hero, if you could say. So let me get to it.
Ben, played by Dwayne Jones.
Ben, played by Dwayne Jones, is a man of color, and that was not intended in the script. That was not initially present in the conception of the story, but it colors things, especially how the movie ends. And that sort of social awareness and social commentary would remain prevalent through Romero's, well, films just in general. We spoke about the remake of The Crazies not too long ago, and The Crazies was Romero, and that one had social commentary present as well. You can't forget the idea of the zombie as consumer, as a social commentary. You can't forget the concept of the zombie as communist as a concept, as it existed at the time when the movies were being made. The zombie is a very malleable, mutable thing. And like I said, this is the beginning of it all, and it's one of the best when it gets going. Up until that point, it's just I guess housework with Dwayne Jones, which is fine enough, but you can only watch someone hammer a board for so long before you start to lose it.
They're coming to get you, Barbara. That line reading is iconic to me.
It's
It's
legendary.
chilling almost. Just the sort of dead way that the actor does it. There's so much of that idea in this movie. The fact that the living dead, these zombies, they go
It's not
against
just a
every.
vi it's not just a virus.
No.
The dead rise from their graves, but it's also transmitted through the bites.
Yeah. And that's very interesting. This is one of the most profitable independent movies ever made. It was made for $114,000 and has made, as of 2022, over 263 times its budget back. And that's incredible.
And Romero got so little of that because they changed the title at the last minute, and when they changed the title, they forgot to put the copyright tag on the movie. So the movie has remained uncopyrighted. And
Sucks for
it's
Romero,
cost
but
him
we were able
so
to find it
much.
on YouTube.
We watched it on Shudder, but we were able to find it on
Better
YouTube.
stream quality, no ads. But
Yeah.
you could find this pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, it's very easy to find, and
There's
it
also
is
a colored ver
stock.
there's also a colorized version,
Yeah,
which
there is.
your mileage may vary, but probably stick to black and
There are
white.
so many interesting parts of the script when you get all of these people together that you're just seeing these little moments of what their past lives were. With very little explanation, it feels like these people have just been thrown into these situations. And that is a very interesting part of it, that these people are so different and they rub up against each other in the worst possible ways. They would do so if there weren't zombies, but the zombies accelerate things. There is a remake of this that was directed by Tom Savini, which I shit you not, stars Tony Todd as Ben.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Is it
Any
good?
good?
It's all right. I mean, it just can't be as groundbreaking as the original was. I
Sure.
actually think I talked about it on one of the very, very, very early episodes of the podcast. I think.
Is it better in pa is it better in pace?
Oh yes, the pacing, it's much more modern. Yes, I
Yeah.
talked about it in the first episode of this podcast, the very
Wow.
first.
How about
How
that?
about that? But yeah, this is just iconic. It's known as a horror classic for a reason. There are so many interesting things here. Obviously, the budget wasn't as high as Romero clearly wants it to be, because he's got so many ideas. But they stretch it as far as they can. Fire stunts, explosions, decapitations, squibs going off. The makeup on some of the people is excellent, and the choice for it to be in black and white, which it is, it's a choice, is a great one because it harkens back to the B movies of
Universal.
the 50s, and that
Yeah, it harkens
is
back to Universal horror, so.
exactly, and that is such a great choice that this is that bridging point between a more modern form of horror and that more classic idea. Romero would go on to create so many more horror films and have such an iconic career, but he never got the financial compensation that he deserved. And his movies after that have suffered for it, which is a fucking shame, because he is one of the grandfathers of this entire genre that we love so much. And so many horror filmmakers have praised Romero as being one of the ones that got them into it. Toby Hooper has spoken at length about it, him. So many horror movie directors have so much to thank Romero for. But this is definitely dull at the beginning. It gets going when all of the characters meet up in the house. And that's where it's at its best, these conflicting people in a fucked up situation. And that's fantastic. Yes, as we said, we found this on Shudder.
But you can find it anywhere,
Yeah. We
really.
also did watch The Coronation, also definitely dull until stuff got going. I did like the musical moments, though. Some of those.
So the opera singers were particularly good.
Yeah, the acoustics in that church, incredible.
We have also watched Pride and Prejudice from 2016, directed by Burr Steers. Please don't say anything, either of you. Sparks fly when spirited Elizabeth Bennet, played by Lily James, meets single rich and proud Mr. Darcy, played by Sam Riley. But Mr. Darcy reluctantly finds himself falling in love with a woman beneath his class. Can each overcome their own pride and prejudice? Sorry, I think I've missed something. Hold on. Just checking my notes. Oh yes, can they also overcome the zombie hordes plaguing Regency England? It is Pride and Prejudice and zombies. John, say a short piece about it.
I really enjoyed this. I know that that might seem strange, and this didn't get the greatest reviews in the world, but it did everything I wanted from it. The zombies are disgusting and interesting. They've got an interesting spin on it. Burr Steers puts this movie together in a very fun way. The editor, Parik McKinley, I think, did a good job at giving this verve and pep. And that comes to the performances as well. The dialogue from the original Jane Austen Pride and Prejudice sings coming out of some of these actors like Lily James and Sam Riley. But then, just as you're getting comfortable with all of this really well-written dialogue about love and class and those kinds of things. It's like a young woman must know how to succeed in polite society. A young woman must be many things: kind, well-read, and accomplished. But to survive the world as we know it, you'll need other qualities.
It's like going from. It's like watching Emma, but it's a werewolf movie.
Yeah, it's
Badly
like
done, Emma. Now we need to get inside before the full moon rises.
so you get so comfortable, and then someone says something where it's like, "What?" And then zombies show up, and that is such a fun idea in my eyes. The energy of this movie is impeccable. I found myself cackling at the top of my lungs at multiple moments in this, and yeah, I don't know what to say. It just was a fun movie to watch in my eyes. Well, did it breeze through the original plot? Absolutely. You kidding?
Well, you needed to make room for the kung fu
But yeah,
fights.
exactly. We needed to make room for, the zombie plot in this. And the zombie plot is interesting, but I won't get into the spoilers about that because that's where more of the interesting stuff happens. I love the fact that it's not Pride and Prejudice and then zombies attack. No, these are characters who have lived with this as a truth their entire lives. And all of the things that that would entail change the plot of the original in interesting directions. And I like that. Yeah.
This is what we have fan fiction for?
Yeah.
Like, think about it. The three biggest concepts for fan fiction are alternate pairings, high school AUs, and what if zombies.
Yeah.
And I love the idea that you could basically grab any book from the past, merge it with the concept of zombies, and get something interesting. This is what adaptation brings to us. It gives us fresh eyes and a fresh lens to look at a story and characters from. The film's an alternate history. The point of divergence comes in the 18th century with the arrival of the zombie plague, indicating very interestingly that the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars just never happened. Like, full stop. So, like, the shape of Europe is completely different. The entire landscape of England is changed irrevocably. London is surrounded by this sort of like dead zone, and outside of that is like basic standard Regency England, but there are roaming bands of zombies just around. But they're not mindless. They strategize, they ambush, they're smarter than your traditional undead. Lily James as Elizabeth Bennet would have been a really solid choice, even in just a normal version of Pride and
Yeah.
Prejudice. But she also gets the real opportunity to not just kick ass in a dialogue sense, but literally do so. And that's really fun.
It's the
Because.
literalization of the battles of wit becoming actual fist fights.
Yeah, and Riley is also really strong with that too. But the funniest performance in the movie is Matt Smith as Parson Collins.
The thing I remember most about this movie, because I saw it in the cinemas, is all of these, this woman carrying all of these like heavy boxes and heavy luggage, like just piled high with it.
It's
And
Elizabeth is like carrying the rifles and
yeah.
shit.
And Matt Smith like comes hurrying over and says, "Oh, it's all right. Chivalry isn't dead." And he takes like her purse and leaves her to carry the rest of it.
No, he doesn't take anything off of her. He adjusts the guns so they sit better
Oh, okay.
and walks off.
And it's so interesting. Jane Austen clearly has something in it for low state members of the clergy, like vicars and stuff. Because there's the vicar in Pride and Prejudice, there's the vicar in Emma, who are both just absolute tosses.
And Matt Smith brings his A
Oh,
game.
he
He
knows
is
exactly what this movie is meant to
hilarious.
be.
Like, he's not just funny, he's that step above funny that whenever he appears on screen, you know he's gonna say something or do something that just makes you want to hit him. And
Yeah.
it's so funny. Especially when he's interacting with this story's version of Catherine, who is the technically the aunt in a manner of speaking to Mr. Darcy, and that's Lena Headey.
And she is spoken
of as... She is known
as
the most dangerous woman in England because of her proficiency at slaying zombies.
Yeah.
She even lost her eye in the Battle of Kent or some shit against the undead, so she got an eye patch and shit.
Yeah, doesn't... Oh, who is it? I think the Bennett mom says, "I really like your eye patch. Is it fashion or function?" And Lena Headey just looks at her with her one good eye and says...
Function. Charles Dance plays Mr. Bennett here.
He doesn't get the opportunity to kick as much ass as he probably should have.
But he gives us the opening monologue explaining the history of the zombies arriving in England. And it's great. But he doesn't get to kick any ass.
What did you think of this, Lawson?
I think it's a real lost opportunity.
I really like it. I think it's a lot of fun. It does what it says on the tin. It's not, you know, high art, but it's very entertaining. It's on the list, so I think I've got a 4K Blu-ray of it sitting in a cupboard waiting for me to get to the 2016 portion of the
list. It's a good entrance point to get into the Pride and Prejudice story because it makes it a little... No, but you know what I mean. Like, it literalizes certain things that would, in other cases, just be dialogue scenes. Yeah. And I think that's a good way of getting younger people interested and then eventually showing them another version of it. Sort of like Emma was such a witty and quick movie and such a modern pace to it that it's similar in that sense, that it's a good entrance way for a modern audience to get into the actually just perfectly written Jane Austen originals.
I just love what they do with Wickham. Like, it's so high stakes, the ending of this movie. It's ridiculous. It's high stakes in a way that was more... It's high stakes in a literal way, as opposed to the emotional high stakes of the Wickham elements of the story in the original book and other more solid adaptations. And it's stupid. It's so stupid, but it's so fun.
It's like... People are saying all of this flowery stuff, and then it's almost as if they turn to the camera and say, They're here. And then zombies just start piling in outside the room. And it's so fun.
The entire cast looks like they're having a blast.
Yeah.
And they make the language from the original novel work. They make it sing.
Yeah.
Like,
and
this is the kind of cast you would have...
Yeah,
for
exactly.
A traditional version of the story.
All of
but
these
people
are perfect.
But you've also got them roundhouse kicking zombies in their head.
Yeah.
It's like the perfect melding and marriage of both of my interests. Dumb, stupid action and a Regency period drama. I had an incredibly great time with this. Had less of a great time with the crowning of King Charles, the coronation. But it does... fit in a way into zombie.
What
zombie
if?
Week.
Bear with me here. What if he rode a horse across London Bridge that had collapsed and then killed a bunch of zombies?
I would have loved that.
That would be awesome. I love how that when that happens, you
awesome.
See
that would be objectively awesome.
You see just a bunch of zombies falling into this giant moat, just in the background of an incredibly sincere scene, and it's so great.
But the coronation, we're not going to talk much about it. But it technically counts because it is the Shambly corpse of a monarchy. But there's also just a hell of a lot of normal shambling going around.
There was a
they
guy who had an
that
incredible moustache, though.
Oh, I'm going to send this picture.
Yeah, I've seen it. This walrus-looking
like,
guy.
Looks
like he's wearing
like,
a disguise.
He looks like Fallon from The Prestige. He looks
oh, yeah,
exactly
you're talking
like
about
Fallon
the guy who
from
was
The Prestige.
Sat next to Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mop man.
Yeah, like
he looks like a scarecrow.
Incredible vibe.
Absolutely incredible.
I'm sorry, but when Boris Johnson turned up, comb your hair. It's a fucking coronation.
You're in a church. Come on.
Show some dignity. I know you don't have it, Boris, but show it at least. But yeah, it's safe to say we're not monarchists. We're all anti-monarchy here.
You really
but it
didn't
is
want
historic.
To say Republicans, did you?
It gets a bad
rap. We don't want
in the United
people to
States.
Get confused.
Smaller.
But it is a historic event. The coronation of a king. It's been 70 years since the last coronation. But we won't have to wait as long till the next one. Because, like, Queen Elizabeth was in her 20s.
Yeah,
when she was coronated.
Check clears.
And, you know, this is the oldest monarch ever crowned.
That's true.
Of England. And
he looks
it. Itself is
when he's holding the scepter and ball, he's
that
just.
That shit is solid gold. It is ridiculously heavy. He's an old man.
The look on his face is that of, just want to go home. Just
I also love, like, the guy's putting the just crown on his head. And he's, like, trying to, like, massage it on. Because it's not properly fitted for his head. It's a crown.
The fact that he only gets to wear it once and then it goes back in a medically sealed box.
He, like, leans over and checks that it's sitting properly and then walks off.
If I were Charles,
it was amusing at least.
If I was Charles, I would be pissed that I couldn't wear that crown again. Because that's just going in a hermetically sealed cabinet in the Tower of London.
Oh. And we just need to confirm, no, the Grim Reaper was not sighted at the coronation. That was simply a functionary of the proceedings. It's
eerie. The Grim Reaper.
A big black coat and what appears to be a stick.
Yes. The stick is just a ceremonial thing left over from back when they actually might have had to whack someone with it.
I mean, it's like, I understand why people would see the Grim Reaper when they see that.
Well, yes, because he walks across frame like he's out of that scene from Exorcist 3. Like, you could almost put the exact musical sting from it in there.
That someone's got to do that edit, right? That's got to be on YouTube eventually.
Yeah, so I want someone to, like, chroma key in the thing with the huge scissors just walking across.
Like Clock Tower.
No, the one from Exorcist 3.
Oh, that. Okay, sorry. I thought you were talking about Clock Tower, but that's got big scissors too.
Yeah.
Mainly, I was waiting for someone to stuff something up.
Oh, yeah, someone tripping and falling.
Someone tripping over or dropping something, but unfortunately, that did not occur.
They ran a tight ship. And
yeah, they ran a tight ship.
They probably should. They've been planning it for 50 years.
Yeah, but no, it was interesting to see history get made.
Yeah.
You
can find the recording of that on YouTube,
pretty much
Stan, ABC.
The news.
Shudder, eventually.
You will see stuff. And
right,
it's...
now I have to put this in the episode description. Apparently it's got, like, an official page on IMDb, so...
It's something we watched, Lawson. We're going to mention it. We don't normally mention live performance stuff, but, you know.
Is that technically a piss take, though?
No, I think... It's basically...
It was a broadcast.
Yeah,
it's documentary.
Like, yeah. Piss take is something that cannot be accessed on your as a viewing experience on your television, I feel, or
sure.
In cinemas.
Yeah, and video games are to piss takes because they're an interactive medium.
Yeah,
so we will be moving on from this. I just do want to say that we had to pause Piranha 3D in the middle to watch the coronation, and then. Get back to
back
watching
off.
Piranha 3D, so...
That must have been such a weird experience.
Actually, not really. I think
it
we paused it at just the right moment.
Lawson, ultimately, it worked. There were gills everywhere in both.
Alright, here's a question for you. Who do you recast with John Lithgow in the coronation?
Charles.
Charles.
Obviously.
Everything. Look, I might come around on the whole idea if John Lithgow was King of England.
Yeah.
Just by
I'm
unanimous.
Sure we could make it work.
Unanimous consent.
He's got my vote.
We could make it work, guys. Let's get on it.
Yeah.
They've still got most of the shit set up. Like, come on.
Yeah, just let Lithgow have a spin of it.
But yeah, so that's what we've seen within the week. Now we will play for you the trailer to Piranha 3D.
See that gap right there?
Yeah.
Quake opened that up. Now it's a connecting passage.
Descending fissure.
Oh my god. It's at least 200 feet, Novak.
in my lake.
Is that a piranha?
This particular piranha vanished 2 million years ago.
I'm thinking about closing the lake.
There's us, and there's 20,000 kids. You do the math.
Take it off!
The sheriff has declared an emergency.
Don't worry, we got P over here!
Piranha hunt in packs. The first bite draws blood. Blood draws the pack.
That was the trailer for Piranha 3D. It is a remake of the 1978 film Piranha, directed by Joe Dante, and it's directed by Alexandra Aja. It's set in the small town of Lake Victoria, Arizona, where it's spring break, baby! Yeah! Woo!
Woo!
High school senior Jake Forrester, played by Stephen R. McQueen, the grandson of that other Stephen McQueen you may have heard of.
Yes.
You know, the legend, everyone.
And second cousin to Enrique Iglesias. He is going to be your hero, baby.
He just wants to enjoy the parties that have taken over his lakeside home every spring break. But unfortunately, his single mother, Julie, played by Elizabeth Shue, is the sheriff. And her increased workload during that period necessitates his abstention in favor of babysitting his younger siblings.
His annoying younger siblings.
Jake can't resist sneaking away this year, though, after a sleazy adult film producer named Derek Jones, played by Jerry O'Connell, hires him to show Derek and his merry band of pornographers the best local environments to shoot dirty movies in. Jake's more than a little uncomfortable when Derek convinces his crush Kelly, played by Jessica Zaw, to come along and then starts trying to convince her to do X-rated things on camera. But soon those concerns are overtaken by a more violent kind. An earthquake the previous evening has opened a subterranean passage beneath the lake, releasing a pack of prehistoric piranha from a concealed underground cavern. They're vicious, hungry, and poorly animated. And despite the best efforts of Sheriff Forrester, a visiting scientist named Novak, played by Adam Scott, and local pet store owner Mr. Goodman, played by Christopher Lloyd, these fish gone wild are about to crash spring break. Bummer. So, before we get too deep into this, why don't we each go around and give our timed 30-second thoughts on what we thought of Piranha 3D.
Yep.
Why don't you start us off, John? You ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
Greg Nicotero and his team, who did the practical effects for this movie, are the best part. The gore. The running red in the massacre on the beach is fantastic. The seemingly waterproof makeup and effects that they've done are just incredible. Other than that, the movie isn't really saying much of anything else.
You ready, Harley?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
I had fun with it. Like Jordan said, the practical effects are simply incredible work. The piranhas themselves, less so, but there's stuff to be said about the process behind the movie to explain that. But other than that, the movie story is pretty simple. It's Jaws adjacent, not doing much new. It's not my favorite Alexandra Aja film. I think we've already discussed my favorite of Aja's films before in a different episode.
I like this movie. I find myself liking it less the longer it goes on, but I think ultimately it still comes out on top. I think it's a decent satire of these kinds of like trashy exploitation movies, although it does fall into a pitfall very, very often of the fact
it steers too hard into it.
You can't be satire if you're just doing the thing.
Exactly.
And I think that this movie does that too often.
Mm. It doesn't thread the needle.
And this is the interesting thing. I think that this is an interesting tack to take. It's the right tack to take if you're making a Piranha remake in 2010. is to make it a comedy, is to make it parody or a satire. And it is. It doesn't really bear much relationship with the original Joe Dante movie other than the concept of killer piranhas.
And it's a pretty silly concept.
Yeah, they've taken this to its most absurd endpoint in a parody of those creature feature movies. Because the original piranha...
The movie is chock full of references to other creature features, including chiefly Jaws.
Yes, we start the movie with Richard Dreyfuss in a boat being eaten by piranhas, playing a character with the same name as his character in Jaws.
When we started the movie, Dad was like, "Is that Richard Dreyfuss?"
And apparently, Amity brand beer.
He didn't want to do it, and then they offered him more money.
And then he donated it to charity.
Yeah.
That's a pretty baller move, I have to say.
It's an idea that was apparently not well received by Harvey Weinstein, who produced this movie. He thought that it was going to
be the king of good ideas.
He thought it was going to be more like Jaws instead of a comedy, and it was
so he didn't read the script.
Apparently not.
Idiot.
He's not really the right brain type kind of guy. Beyond everything else about him, he just seemed to not be very good at producing stuff.
But those original Piranha movies were following on from Jaws. They were the rip-offs. Yeah. They were the knock-on effect of Jaws. Jaws sort of spawned that whole creature feature wave in the late 70s, 80s. And this is one of the more successful ones, I think, is remembered as. But it's almost more remembered in my estimation nowadays for its sequel being technically James Cameron's first movie, Piranha 2, The Spawning, which technically he was fired off of partway through filming and ended up being completed by someone else, and he's kind of disowned. Although I believe he said that it's entertaining enough to watch late at night after you've had a few drinks. But
which I'm sure is the way Alexandria Aja thinks about this movie.
So I do think it was the right idea, and kind of if you're going to bring back Piranha in the present day, and it kind of beggars belief that you would before a whole bunch of other things, but if you are going
chiefly
to,
Jaws.
then this is the correct tack to take. But like I said, it's a fine line with satire to satirize something without just doing the thing. And this movie is only partially successful at that. It really comes down to the scene.
Aja drunkenly stumbles over the line. And which is kind of fitting because of its setting and its the events in the movie. It's a spring break situation, which...
Which I don't think we've spoken about a spring break situation on the podcast before.
I don't think so, no. Which is odd, considering our reputation as party animals.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus, we have to drag Lawson in here from his hangovers.
Yes.
Because
every night, Party Rock is in my house.
Everybody going to have a good time. Would it be a surprise that the whole vibe just didn't gel with me?
No,
one,
not at all.
I don't drink. Two, I don't party. And three, I don't swim.
Four, you don't
identify
women.
I also don't like
women.
Going into the goddamn desert.
Can you swim, or do you just not like to
swim?
I
can't.
You can't swim.
I am terrified of water that I could possibly sink in.
You know that this is a solvable problem, right?
Yes, but like I said, I'm terrified
of
drowning.
Yes, but I'm just saying that as the decades go by, the likelihood of encroaching water becomes more of a concern.
No, I know. I'm just going to move inland.
That's why he plans to live far, far, far above sea level.
I do think that
enjoy your death traps on the coast.
I do think I'm kind of torn about the spring break part of it, right? Because on the one hand, I get it.
It's a good way of getting a lot of people, a lot of young people, to get massacred.
Well, yes, but it's also a big part of the satire.
Yeah.
Of these sort of 70s, 80s exploitation movies of a lot of nudity, a lot of young people just dancing around naked for no reason. It's the grinding. I think intentionally, it's so over the top. It's so tawdry and completely beyond the pale that it loses all impact. It loses all any shock value it might have after, you know, the first few scenes of that kind of stuff. And by the time you get to the underwater sort of swim sequence, it's just kind of, it's lost any impact that it might have had.
If
Piranha 3D had entirely too much gyrating, and the coronation had surprisingly little.
Well, this is the thing.
If Harmony Korine's Spring Break movie is less...
Is more classy
than...
Oh, there are plenty of entries in the IMDb Parents Guide section this week to get to later on, but a lot of them I just couldn't mention because they're borderline pornographic. The details.
Which is what this movie is, Lawson. There were porn actresses here.
Yes, there are. Yes, there's one main one who is one of the girls on the boat. But I think there's like...
Is it the actress with more prominence in it?
No, the blonde.
It's the other one. It's the blonde.
The British lady is
a model and actress, yes. Who
really good too.
Some quote from her saying, oh, it was really difficult to do that underwater sequence because you got to hold your breath while doing this choreography.
I know, like, that lung capacity.
Yeah,
damn.
But she's like, we had to get so much practice together. Like, she's like playing into it. She understood the project that she was in, I think. But
that underwater sequence is like pretty remarkably shot in stage two.
Well, that's the thing. Alexandra Aja is a really good director. And that's the thing that makes this movie ultimately successful and also to me kind of troubling is how competent from a filmmaking perspective he is. That can at times, I think, undercut the movie's effectiveness because he can sometimes simply fall into the trap of making a really effective scene. And I'm thinking chiefly of the massacre scene of all of the Spring Breakers.
It's so good.
It's so incredibly well executed that it completely disrupts the goofy tone for me.
Like
it's genuinely so disturbing.
There's blood it's everywhere. That guy who gets on the boat is like, get away, and just runs over a bunch of people, grinds up a woman's hair in the thing, and just rips her scalp off. Christ.
Like, these are all
But the cheesy part of that scene is Ving Rhames.
Yeah.
Pulling the propeller of a boat
like
and just going to town on
the
piranhas.
He's in the sequel, Ving Rhames.
He lives.
And
oh, thank Christ.
Paul Scheer is now his carer, and they're trying...
Yeah, because Paul Scheer disappears.
Yes. There was a scene in which he was eaten in the water, but they cut it for time. It's on the Blu-ray. But they'd allowed them to bring him back in the sequel, and... He is now inexplicably Ving Rhames' carer, and their group therapy together has suggested that they go to this water park to get over their aquaphobia, basically, after the piranhas. But of course, unluckily, this day they go
piranhas
to the water park is the day where the piranhas get through the pipes into the water park. But like, you get all this comedy where Ving Rhames is like, he's in a wheelchair now because his legs are gone. And he's like, you know, just push me in. And then when Paul Scheer goes to do it, he's like, no, I don't want to. And then he stops and is like, what did I tell you? Just push me in. But you told me to stop. Just push me in no matter what I say. And then he tries it again and people start like picking on Paul Scheer for trying to dump the amputee into the water. But then when the piranhas come out, Ving Rhames goes like ice cold and just goes, bring me my legs. And Paul Scheer like brings out these like prosthetic metal legs that have shotguns in them. So like a chorus line dancer, Ving Rhames is like kicking up, firing a shotgun, kicking up the other leg, firing a shotgun. And
so
it's
like watching Professor Everett Von Scott doing that part where he's just doing the kicks in
Rocky Horror.
It's the best part of an otherwise pretty awful movie.
Lawson! That sounds rad as hell.
I mean, it's Ving Rhames, isn't it?
In some senses, I'm going to have a maybe controversial take. Piranha 3 Double D, because that is what it is called, is not as good a movie as the first Piranha 3D. But
no!
Oh, really?
That's not my controversial take. My controversial take is that it's maybe more successful as a satire, because it doesn't have the problems that the first movie has in terms of basically being too competent. Because Piranha 3D is made by a hack. It's made by the guy who directed the three Feast movies, which I've already talked about on the podcast. And that seems like, right in line for the guy to make the sequel to Piranha 3D.
No, no. This makes sense. Alexander Audra, you did friggin' Hills of Eyes remake.
Yeah.
What are you doing here?
Well, not only that, but he's coming off of immediately before that High Tension. Before Hills Have Eyes. The only thing that kind of might suggest, all right, it's time to, maybe he needs the job, is that he directed Mirrors between The Hills Have Eyes and Piranha 3D.
Oh, that could have helped.
But the sequel is, it's so much more overtly ridiculous. Like, David Hasselhoff is at this, playing himself, is at this water park as like a celebrity lifeguard. And he just refuses to help anyone when it starts because he's like, I'm not a real life guy.
Lawson, it's an aquatic creature feature. Yeah, but Hasselhoff must be present.
But like,
it's like a law of thermodynamics. It's inevitable.
It's so over the top. It's so ridiculous. Like, David Koechner is running this park and he's fired all of the lifeguards and hired strippers instead. There's like an adult pool.
Like something Derek would have loved.
There's like instead of a children's pool, there's an adult pool where it's basically all just naked women. And there is a like video camera under the water in the ladder section. So when they go to climb out, it's like broadcast on a television on the wall. Like, it's so, so sleazy and ridiculous. Spoilers for Piranha 3DD. When a woman is skinny dipping, a piranha, unbeknownst to her, swims into her vagina. And later on, when she has sex with her boyfriend, it comes back out and bites off his penis.
How wouldn't you know?
I don't know.
Anyway, it seems
I tell a lie. It doesn't bite off his penis. It sort of latches onto it like an angry pug. And then he, instead of just...
So it's like teeth.
Instead of killing the piranha with the knife, decides to cut off his penis, piranha and all.
Sorry, I'm...
Which leads to the immortal line of when this woman runs into her friends to tell them that he's in the hospital. Josh cut off his penis because something came out of my vagina.
Okay, I'm just baffled by the sort of, like, physics of it, so...
John, don't
please. This piranha would have had to swim backwards in, right? In order for its teeth to be...
I don't know. I think it turned...
It wouldn't have been able to turn around because...
Look, if you want to pick apart the physics of Piranha 3DD, then we can do that on another occasion once you've watched it. I'm just bringing all of this up to demonstrate the fact that that movie, in some senses, despite being utter resolute rubbish... is a better sort of example of the sort of just absolute tawdry exploitation crap that these movies are sort of basing themselves on than this first movie is, because Alexandra Aja is too...
Talented.
Too talented, yes. And because, frankly, they're holding themselves to a higher class, a higher standard, which is bizarre thing to say for a movie such as Piranha 3D, but in comparison to its sequel, it is a classier film.
I just know that at that water park in the adult pool section, there's a bench there with Derek's picture on it. Seems like his scene.
He would have liked it if they didn't take his penis.
He died the way he lived, like a pervert.
Well... That is sort of interesting element, is they've sort of latched, and it is one of the more subversive elements, and kind of ends up being uncomfortable, which is, again, I think a problem with Aja's sort of slightly more intellectual take on the material than you might expect.
Right?
He plays it straight.
When the stupid elements show up.
Well, it's that whole sort of Girls Gone Wild parody thing, with these two underage teenagers that are there, and the weird, like, getting the girls drunk and everything, and it's so sleazy, and the movie knows it's sleazy and is presenting it as sleazy, but it's doing it so straight-faced that you almost might expect it to be like a hard-hitting drama about, you know, Joe Francis, who I believe was the name of the guy who ran the actual Girls Gone Wild site and ended up going to prison for filming underage people.
And ended up trying to sue the producers of this movie.
I think he threatened to sue. I don't think he went through with it, but he threatened to because it was like such a caricature of him, which is basically, yeah, that's what happens when you're a public figure. It's a parody. But that's a big part of this movie that is so uncomfortable, is the sort of the back and forth between Derek and Jake and his crush Kelly on this boat, because it's satire, but it's also so played straight in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's the part where Derek asks Kelly to do something and she says no. No, she says,
she says no thanks.
And Jake is like, Derek, she said no. And then Derek gets all up in Jake's face and says, no, she said no thanks, because she understands gratitude.
Yeah, there's like a weird... It's like...
He also can't handle his coke.
It's almost like a... Yeah, it's a... it's a mixture of like... It's almost like starting to creep into some like Euphoria level, like teen angst and drama, and like uncomfortable drama, which is what that show, like, it's a really...
And Derek is played by Jerry O'Connell, star of Kangaroo Jack.
Yeah. But then at the same time, you've got the absolute, like, so out there, so ridiculous, so over the top, like that underwater segment where it's almost like, I mean, it's like a naked version of Homer eating those chips in space in that one episode of The Simpsons.
Kind of. It's elegant.
Yeah. And it is so ridiculous, and it's so graphic in terms of what it shows. And
it goes
it's also,
on for too long.
They can't hold their breaths that long. Like,
no, it's like that lung capacity is insane.
And that's the thing that constantly trips the movie up, I think, is the sort of push-pull between really gratuitous stupidity and graphic sex and nudity and Arja's apparent inability to do some of these scenes without doing them as successfully and without winking as he can.
Like, it's such a thin line to tread.
Yes, and once it starts combining the nudity and the sex with the violence, I'm so uncomfortable with that. I'm so ill at ease with that. I think that the most disturbing part of the movie for me is the one where the woman gets sort of bisected through the shoulder and down to the side, and it cuts her top away. It's such an unnecessary piece of nudity, which is, I think, the point. I think that's what Arja is doing, because I think he's trying to satirize the connection between sex and nudity and violence in horror movies and exploitation movies. But the result, as I said, is so po-faced about it that it just stops satirizing the thing and becomes the thing. And because he's such a good filmmaker, you don't even get the wonkiness and the shoddiness that you would get if a hack directed it. Instead, you get like a genuinely disturbing moment that is sexualized to a degree that is so, so revolting that, like, that was the moment where I sort of, the movie lost me and kind of never got me back, because...
It also looks like trash.
Yeah, but because, like, that comes at the very start of that whole sequence, and then after that you got it all going on. It's so mean-spirited and exploitative in terms of what it does to that woman.
It seems out of place.
Yeah, that after that I'm out of the movie, and I'm starting to analyze this as the scene is unfolding in a more critical way I'm ill at ease with the cruelty, and so that's all I see now, and then I can't get back on the movie's wavelength. You know what I mean?
I completely see it.
By the time we get to the end where those guys are carrying that woman out and one of them walks too far backwards and she literally comes apart at the middle. Like, it's just so... And I get that's what the point was. I get that's the whole point of this spring break thing is then to completely disrupt it with the horror angle and to really go so over the top with the violence in the same way they'd be going so over the top with the flesh and the nudity. But the problem is that either element on their own, when used so over the top in style, loses shock value, loses impact, becomes a satirical object. When they're used together, it just trips off so many red flags and so many like emergency sirens for me. And in most ways it's a crossing of a line. It's an exploitation of something that is actually really foul that becomes a it completely interrupts the movie's flow.
But on that scene, those practical effects are incredible.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's what makes it so disturbing.
Yeah, like
you're seeing like
Greg Nicotero put the work
flash.
In, and to do that with water in that heat
the hair in the water jet ski that then the propeller rips away, like that's
it's the second Scorpio I saw this week.
What was the first?
Evil Dead.
Oh, okay, right. But I
forgot about that. That was the first ooh that we got from you in Evil Dead Rise.
Was she doing another coronation joke? I didn't know where that was going.
No, there was no scalpings there.
Not yet.
I will give them credit for that because that's an incredibly huge sequence.
Oh yeah.
That is pulled off really well technically, even if I think the effect on it is so destructive. I think that the technical skill on display in its execution is extreme. And the fact that it was a $24 million budget, that they've got all of those extras.
It's incredible.
And as they say, you know, you have to control all of those elements. Like they're talking on the behind the scenes. There is literally a 2-hour documentary on the making of this film that is longer than the film itself. I watched it. So I spent a lot of time with Piranha 3D.
More time than Paulie Alexandria Aja did.
Yeah, but pardon me. But like they talk about in that, there's so much going off. There's so much moving machinery. The whole thing with the stage tipping over, all of that stuff. Like there's so many moving parts, and it's so complicated to shoot because you've got all of these people in the water. And at the same time, you run into the same problems that every movie to do with water runs into, which is it's a nightmare to shoot with. Yeah. So I will give them a lot of credit.
Apparently, it was like bleeding hot too.
Mm. I think they actually shot in Arizona.
So like that's so complex, and Nicotero and his team did probably above and beyond what was necessary.
Oh yeah,
like, because does end up legitimately disturbing. Like,
if you
Orson
compare
said.
The makeup effects and all of that stuff, all of the deaths in this movie, and you compare it to the CG, woof. Holy shit.
That's very specific circumstances behind the
damn.
CG.
I will just read you something from the movie's Wikipedia page. It sounds like you guys have already seen it, but for any of our listeners who haven't, quote, 8 years after the film's release, Aja spoke of post-production disputes that occurred while finishing the film. He claimed that Dimension found effects artists that were much cheaper than the ones they had currently employed. This included artists who never did conversion work before. By June 2010, not a single Piranha was completed for the film. Speaking, by the way, that's June 2010. The movie came out on August 20th. Leading to Aja reaching out to the Directors Guild of America to remove his name from the credits out of frustration. Bob Weinstein caught wind of this and fired all of the artists and instead hired every VFX vendor available to finish the film. So when you consider that, so that's June 2010. So June, July, August, less than 3 months before this movie went to cinemas worldwide.
Yeah.
Not a single Piranha in this movie had been rendered. And there are a lot of Piranhas in this movie.
A shitload, one could say.
Yes.
And I think that the modeling and movement for the Piranhas is really good. It's simply how they work with the physical elements. That's where it really falls apart.
I will say, okay, I'm going to try and find some things to praise because I've taken Piranha to task so far.
Well, you already praised the practical effects.
I did, yes. But I'm gonna praise the basic storyline. There are times where a lot of times where the tone troubles me, but I think that the storyline that they've come up with for this premise is good. Like they've not, it's not Citizen Kane, but it doesn't need to be. Like they found a good premise to follow
it's
along through all
feature.
Of this. It's a creature feature. It put brings in all of the right character types for them to satirize what they want to satirize. It unfolds in pretty much exactly the way that it should, just from a plot skeleton structure. And everyone doing it is really enthusiastic. Like all of the actors seem to be having fun. You get a lot of really good opportunities for famous faces. Obviously Adam Scott, but he has the biggest role out of a lot of the supporting famous faces. But then obviously there's Ving Rhames, Christopher Lloyd, who I'm convinced was there for maybe half a day.
Elizabeth Shue.
Elizabeth Shue, yes. But then obviously the cameos of Richard Dreyfuss. Eli Roth is the director. Not the director, the DJ on the float at the spring break party. And then there's obviously Paul Scheer, who isn't really a cameo and wasn't really a famous face at the time, but has sort of become famous to, you know, pop culture enthusiasts because of How Did This Get Made?
Yeah.
Interesting
to hear an episode on Piranha 3D from him.
I wouldn't put it past them, frankly.
that would be... It would just be interesting to get his perspective.
Yeah. I mean, they all have, I think, made a few cracks at their own work at given times. I think that, I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Paul Scheer. It was a few years ago. There was a movie that was out. I can't even remember the name of it. That he said at the end when they were doing the plug, it's like, oh, this is currently in cinemas now. Go check it out. It's already one of the worst reviewed movies of the year. but I think that this movie mines a lot of credibility from its cast.
Yeah.
Mm.
Specifically the fact that it chooses a lot of B-movie stars.
Yeah.
Obviously, Adam Scott is more of a comedic actor and Paul Scheer is a comedic actor, but when you're bringing in people like Ving Rhames and Christopher Lloyd and the like, even Richard Dreyfuss, but Eli Roth, that you know what you're doing when you're bringing in those people. I think that we're reaching the end here.
Yeah.
Do you guys have anything else to add, really?
No, not really. Just sort of heap on some more praise to Greg Nicotero and his VFX group, because holy shit. Not just in that one scene, but in other parts where Derek gets dragged out of the water, half his body is just bitten to
bones and shit.
And he's just like, my penis, Jake. They took my penis. Like, the effect there is horrific.
All right, then. Why don't we now move on to the...
Oh, I also want to say, when they're climbing over the rope between the boats, why would you all go at once?
Exactly.
Do you not understand how physics works? You will drop, and it's more heavy.
That's because this movie is the kind of movie that cannot stand to have a woman get naked and then survive. Frankly, that's... We had an extraneous, beautiful woman there, so she needed to be killed in the most graphic manner they could think of.
I would have preferred if she survived. I think that would have been more talking about the genre than anything.
It'd be more satirical for damn sure.
Well, why don't we now move on to the IMDb Parents Guide for this movie? For the people who are not regular listeners, the IMDb Parents Guide is where we talk about the prudish and or pervy entries in the IMDb Parents Guide for the movie that we discuss each week.
Good lord, there are some whoppers here.
As I said, well, why would you read them, John, and spoil yourself on them?
I didn't read all of them.
Well, you'll at least get one fresh opinion, Lawson, because I didn't look at them.
The sex and nudity section, as I said, I had to ignore most of it because it was, frankly, pretty X-rated. Almost scientific levels of definition on body parts.
We are an adult rated podcast. We have an explicit tag.
Mostly because of Sean.
Well, and mostly because I decided to put it there.
Yes,
because
it just frees our hands. Especially
we discuss
given...
explicit topics like murder and shit like that. So
yeah.
It's going to come up. But it would push the boundaries of that explicit tag.
Yeah. We have a reputation to uphold.
We're higher class than that.
Anyways, in the sex and nudity section, it's a college spring break genre movie. Of course, there is lots of T&A, mostly, notably, the mainstream porn star Riley Steele and model Kelly Brook swimming very visibly fully nude for a few minutes. It could be considered art if O'Connell wasn't making it dirty. That, by the way, is all one sentence with no full stop whatsoever.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah.
In the violence section, people are seen being absolutely demolished by fish.
True. Yep,
that is explicitly true. And it is demolished.
Two men carry a teenage girl with severe injuries and accidentally tear her in half. We hear the sound effects. It is not known whether she survived, but it is played for laughs. Guy, I'm telling you right now, she did not survive. She was.
And I didn't laugh.
Pulled
apart.
I don't
think it was played for laughs. I think it's played for shock.
She was pulled apart at the gut.
She's not coming back.
Not coming back. In frightening and intense sequences. This movie is a nightmare fuel of blood and gore. Literally a shredding machine. Not for kids at all.
Yeah.
Again, no full stops in there.
I would agree with that.
The movie is dark and extremely disgusting and stomach-punching. When I say that, I mean really, really is in capitals.
I wouldn't stress that far.
Lastly, the severed penis is so disgusting, depending on your view.
Yeah, depending if you can see over the top of the people who are watching the movie in the cinema in front of you. Because then you might not see the severed penis.
I think they meant philosophical view, Sean.
Sure.
Jesus, John.
All right.
Okay. So I do have a segment I want to do here.
Okay.
Who in this movie would purchase the blue
Derek.
Checkmark on Twitter?
Derek.
It's yes, Derek.
Derek, definitely.
It's Derek. It's pretty obviously Derek.
These are so not subjective. Like, if we're going to do this as a regular thing, these aren't subjective. These are more objective considerations of character. So I think instead of us having our own individual one, I think we should all just decide as a group. But yes, it's clearly Derek.
It's Derek.
Just in the interest of conversation, if it were not Derek, who?
Ooh. Hmm.
The cameraman.
I don't think so, actually. I think he's a little too anonymous.
The DJ.
I was going to say. Eli Roth is the DJ, yes.
Yeah.
Now, why don't we just go around?
But I mean, okay, question. Derek probably got his account suspended, and then Elon gave it back to him.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
He did one of those fake polls and then quoted Latin as an excuse to put the guy back on.
And then once more... replace the Twitter bird with the Doge dog.
Yes, and just sent poop emojis to any press that contacted him for comment. Now why don't we go around and say who our MVP is for this movie, what our favourite scene or sequence is, and of course, who we would recast with this podcast patron saint, character actor John Lithgow.
Knock, knock, who's there? Me!
I will start us off here, and I will say that my MVP for this movie has got to be... Oh, God, who do I even pick? Look, I will give it to Nicotero and his team. I'm not satisfied with the way that it's deployed in the movie, but there is no denying the craft of what they're doing. Look, it's all tied up in some of the stuff that I reject most about this movie, but it's... really, really good work by him and by the other craftspeople.
The amount of time it would have taken to get all of those things ready. It's just incredible.
Yeah. Favorite scene or sequence?
Every time you go, I just want you to remember, this was your decision.
I know. See, the problem is that every time I have a favorite scene, I think of a favorite scene or sequence, it's always disrupted by something troubling. I think I'm going to go with the whole escape from the boat as it's sinking. At the end, I think that's decent. That's good stuff. It largely avoids the sort of troubling moments that some of the other action sequences get into. And you know, it's some decent piranha action. It's some decent character stuff.
Jake is never leaving his house again.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that. In terms of who I would recast with this podcast patron saint character actor John Lithgow, obviously it's got to be Mr. Goodman, the pet store owner, played by Christopher Lloyd.
It's obvious.
It's so obvious. And it does unfortunately mean that he would also be in the sequel. But that's a price I'm going to have to pay.
So Christopher Lloyd comes back?
He does, yes.
Well, that's
He's like the crank, the harbinger, who no one takes seriously anymore because he apparently wrote a book theorizing that the piranhas are on the verge of evolving to be able to walk on land.
Was he right?
Yes, that's like the last scene of the movie.
Stupid.
So he's not a crank, he's a prophet.
Yes.
I mean, and Lithgow can do harbinger shit.
Mm. But basically you get all of that stuff, you get the same sort of blustery energy. You know, these particular piranha was wiped out millions of years ago. Like, you get the same sort of feel of like, okay, here is upper tier actor coming in here for a moment. Lithgow even
do
more
some
than
mad
Lloyd.
Scientist shit.
Yeah. It's the right spot for him. Although we've all considered, right, how hilarious it would be if he was the DJ.
Yes.
But no, it can't go there. It's got to be him as Mr. Goodman.
For me, my MVP's got to be Greg Nicotero and his team. Not only is the effect of what he does, not only are the practical effects really good, they had to contend with the heat, which can melt the effects, especially the ones that are more rubber-based. They can distort, warp, and stuff like that, quickly dry out. But they also had to contend with water, which is, again, another element that is really difficult to work with in the practical effects space. And the sheer amount, that they had to work with in the Spring Break Massacre scene. I mean, those piranhas have never fed like that, ever. That species has never had a smorgasbord that huge.
Well, yeah, we didn't even mention it, did they? That they have supposedly just been surviving by cannibalizing each other in this underground cavern for literally millions of years.
Well, it's not only that, before they were in the cavern in their natural time, they would have never had that many people in the water, that many living creatures in the water.
Mm.
So the bloodbath is just striking in that regard. And I have to say, as a showcase of what Nicotero and his team are capable of, I have to give it to the massacre scene. I do have some of the same issues as you do, Lawson, particularly in the bi section. But the rest of it is just a showcase of incredible talent, not only in terms of the practical effects, but some of the stunt work. Because that's something we didn't talk about. There's a shitload of stunt actors there, a lot of people who have to be very precise in their movements so that it can even function in a physical space as a scene. Like, shooting that would have been a literal nightmare to deal with. Not only considering, like, the heat, the water, but just the sheer amount of people you have to have involved. You got shit floating in the water, you got boats. Like, as an undertaking, it's just incredible that it actually happened in the first place. And I guarantee that's where most of the budget went. After that, most of the budget went to Dreyfus to get him on board.
I don't know. I'm going to look that up. How much was he paid?
$55,000.
See, that's not most of the budget. They spent $24 million on this thing.
Yeah, fair. But they did a lot of work in this scene.
Yeah, $55,000 for 2 days' work. That's not a bad payday for Dickie Dreyfus.
No.
Especially considering the state of his career in 2010.
I would have to say, for John Lithgow, it's got to be the Christopher Lloyd role, Goodman. Because, really, that's not only the only character that fits his age range and really how much of the movie I'd want him to be in, frankly, but also fits perfectly for the bluster he is capable of as an actor. He would really manage the harbinger energy incredibly well, especially if you give him a full beard. He just works for a role like that. It's sort of perfect for him in a weird way, but I really wouldn't want him to touch this movie with a 10-foot pole. But if I had to, that's my choice.
I have to give my MVP to Greg Nicotero. I mean, the amount of effort put in by him and his team cannot be overstated. The precision with which the effects were constructed, how accurate they would have been. The effort to not only construct those makeup effects, but have them used practically in the water, in the heat, with that many extras around, that many stunt people around. It's such a well put together sequence with some objectionable content for sure, but on its own, if you just lopped off both sides of the movie before it and after it, and you just had that scene, that is a showcase of what both Aja and Nicotero are capable of in terms of putting together a horrific sequence. And it's to that point where I think that's my favorite scene or sequence. It's the moment where my jaw hit the floor with how much effort was put in. And it made the rest of the movie feel cheap in comparison. It felt like... And I had read that stuff about the issues back during post-production on this movie. And watching that particular sequence, the massacre, I was like, oh, you can see all of the effort Aja went into that was not supported by the studio or the producers. You can see the effort that he put in. And I'm actually going to go against the grain from you guys. I love Christopher Lloyd in this. I think he's got the exact right energy. I would replace Ving Rhames with John Lithgow.
Did you make that decision before or after I told you that in the second movie he has shotgun legs?
Before.
It doesn't hurt.
I made that decision before because I think, well, the guy is 6 foot something. He could rip off the motor of a motorboat and friggin' just carve up a bunch of piranhas. He could have shotguns for feet. I can picture that. Plus, it gives him potentially the best moment in the whole movie, which, you know, yeah. I like Ving Rhames here, but I think Lithgow could have elevated that to being god-tier, meme-worthy stuff. And obviously Dreyfus stays, because, I mean, that's the whole point of him being there.
Unless
we recast Richard Dreyfuss' character in Jaws with John Lithgow.
True.
Well, for sure, but...
But that would be, like,
that's changing the past a bit too much.
So, now we're going to put it to a vote, whether or not we're a pro-Piranha 3D podcast or not.
The answer's no. It's just not. Look, I'm not anti this movie. No. I think it's got ideas that it's trying to work through. I just think the execution of it, the effect of it, is wildly haphazard and often disconcerting. I can't go there. No, it was kind of fun to do such a different kind of movie to ones that we have done previously on this podcast. I don't think we've ever done something quite so airheaded as this. Maybe you have to go back to like Lake Placid versus Anaconda, to get to this level. But I mean, it's obvious, like, right? Like, no one here thought that this was going to happen.
No, God, no. I mean, I don't even think we need to take turns. Like, you summed it up.
It sort of defeats the point of doing it in turns in the first
place.
That would
be wasting time. You knocked it out of the park, dude.
There you have it. We are not a pro Piranha 3D podcast.
But there's too much technical proficiency here for it to be anti.
Yeah. Aww. So, if you'd like to reach us, you can find us at each of our blogs. You can find us at X Do the Candy Counter for John and myself on the Bright Side. You can also reach us through our Twitter, which is the best place to give us episode-specific feedback and movie recommendations. What do you think about Piranha 3D? Have you seen it? Have you seen the sequel? What do you think? Do you think Aja is too good for this? You probably do. Did you see the coronation? What did you think? I guess. Oh, if you could choose a Regency, if you could choose like an old novel to plug zombies into,
or piranhas,
what would it be? Or piranhas, I suppose. All of that
Titanic
in the,
with piranhas.
all of that on the Twitter. You can also comment, like, rate, and subscribe on podcast of choice. Just keep in mind that on certain podcast apps, you're commenting on the show on the whole, and on others for specific episodes. But if you are on one of the services that's for the show on the whole, say specifically which episode you're referring to. It just helps us cater the experience for you a little more succinctly. But please do like, rate, comment, and subscribe. You know the Mesolithic piranhas in this film?
Mm-hmm.
They exist. There have been earthquakes that have released them from the underground caves. The film was actually quite correct in that, and that is why no one goes swimming in the ocean anymore.
Thought it would have been the pollution.
No.
Okay.
It's the piranhas.
Didn't have something written for that.
Because you just keep asking questions, no matter how many times he tells you not to
ask
questions.
No, I don't think he had anything written for it, generally.
I wrote it down, I just don't prepare my answers, John. But yeah, so, Lawson, hopefully something a little more classy next week.
Yeah, yeah, well, it doesn't take much to be more classy than Piranha 3D. Next week, we will be talking about another comedy, another very, another comedy, but a more charming and funny one. It is Easy A.
Social Network?
That's not a comedy, John. And I've already told you I haven't watched it yet. We'll be talking about Easy A, the Emma Stone comedy. Have you guys seen this?
No.
Heard of it.
It's very good. It's available.
It's sort of like a Scarlet Letter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's available for streaming in Australia on Binge, Foxtel Now, and 7 Plus, if you're interested. it's also available for rental or purchase on Amazon, YouTube, Fetch, and Apple stores.
Oh, 7 Plus, huh?
7 Plus has ads, though, so, and is only in standard definition.
Watching it on Stan, then.
It's not on Stan, it's on Binge.
Oh, Binge, yeah, on Binge.
So, there you have it. Join us next week for when we discuss Easy A. Ideally with less sharp-toothed aquatic creatures. But you never know. So, I have been Holly Lewis.
I've been Lawson Keeney.
I have been and will continue to be Jean Lewis. They stole my penis!
There's the new ringtone.